It is Monday, the 2nd of December, and this is Kathy bringing you news from the commercial news, primarily with a couple of obituaries from the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. So starting out on Sunday's paper with the commercial news, Stars for Julius. Symphony Choir celebrate the season. It will be as if Julius W. Hegeler II is seated in the front row at the upcoming Danville Symphony Orchestra Christmas concert. DSO has dedicated the concert to Hegeler, a longtime patron and community philanthropist who died July 5th. This concert is not just a tribute to Julius, but a gift to the community, said Jean Dunn, a member of the DSO Community Choir. This is beautiful music. It's going to get the entire community into the spirit. Stars for Julius will begin at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December the 7th, in the Dick Van Dyke Theater at Danville High School. Conductor Jeremy Swirling said it'll be emotionally difficult not seeing Julius sitting there in the as he did for so many years. Since Julius's first experience with the Nutcracker, the Christmas concert has always held a special place in Julius's heart. Marty Lindvall, who will direct the community choir, noted that Hegeler loved Danville, and he would be thrilled to see about 100 voices coming together to welcome the season. It's a way to celebrate him in a grand way, she said. It's just going to be a beautiful concert. People don't want to miss this one, she added. It will warm everyone's heart and will put you in the Christmas mood. The concert will provide a joyous collection of traditional and classic holiday songs. Danville High School's Delegation Show Choir, directed by Jeff Thomas, will join the performance for a few numbers. A unique addition this year is a guest conductor. Voting is underway now until midnight Thursday on the DSO website to select a guest conductor who will lead the orchestra in the holiday favorite, Sleigh Ride. Swirling thinks he said he thinks Julius probably would have enjoyed a turn at conducting. Sometimes during concerts, from the corner of my eye, I would spot Julius waving his hand to the beat as if he had an invisible baton, Swirling said. DSO Executive Director Cindy Nacko said people can vote for one of the five who have agreed to participate in the conductor contest, or they may enter themselves, which an enterprising young student, Navaya Cook, did. Other contestants as of Friday are Dr. Randy Ashton, Stephen Nacko, Wes Beeritz, and Alicia Geddes. Each vote costs $1, and there is no limit on the number of votes a person can buy. Cindy Nacko said it's a way to have fun while raising funds to help support the quality performances that the DSO has brought to our community for more than 50 years. The concert will feature selections by the orchestra, songs by the community choir accompanied by the orchestra, numbers by the DHS delegation, and special guests, middle school students Allie and Aiden Cox, who will be featured in a cute performance of Santa Deer, and Todd Kester on a rock guitar solo. The choir, under Lindvall's direction, will sing favorites such as It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, God Bless Us Everyone, Some Children See Him, Mary Did You Know, and an arrangement of carols including A Holy Night. The audience will be invited to sing along with some of the favorites from childhood. The Delegation Show Choir will perform Text Me Merry Christmas, We Need a Little Christmas, and All I Want for Christmas, and then will combine with the DSO Choir for the concert's grand finale of Handel's Alleluia Chorus from the Messiah. Swirling said symphony lovers will be pleased to know that the orchestra will be featured by itself, including performances of Christmas à la Valse, a Christmas scherzo, and his own personal favorite, A Mad Russian Christmas, as performed by the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. This modern arrangement of Tchaikovsky's Trepak includes the most amazing rock guitar solo that will be performed by Danville's own Todd Kester, and it is sure to rock your Christmas, he said. Jean Dunn, who has done choral singing most of her life, was drawn to this concert because of its presentation of a traditional Christmas music. In addition, she's always wanted to work with Lindvall. I'm thrilled to be having that experience, she said. I'm really excited for our first rehearsal with DSO. Also, she said, the voices are incredible, as well as rehearsal pianist Jill Smith. To the audience, she said, if they want to launch themselves into the Christmas season, this concert of Christmas music won't fail them. Lindvall said the community choir has done other collaborations with the symphony, but this might be the largest group. As for DSO, she said, having a symphony in the community is a treasure. The DSO is a 501c3 organization with a 52-year tradition of bringing orchestral performances to the East Central Illinois region. For more information or for a season subscription, call NACO at 443-5300 or visit the DSO website. And the second front page article, obstacles remain in the casino bid. After years of pushing a Las Vegas-style casino to boost tourism and much-needed revenue, Chicago's leaders seemingly hit the jackpot when Illinois lawmakers approved one as a part of a massive gambling expansion. But obstacles remain before anyone can place any bets. The city must convince state lawmakers to vote on a plan that officials say makes the casino more profitable, as well as choose a location which already has sparked disputes. Here's a look at the issues. Chicago is on track to become the largest American city with a casino, and it's likely to be gigantic. Lawmakers approved up to 4,000 gambling positions, slots, or table seats. Though Chicago could use some positions for airport slots, a Chicago casino could rival those on the Las Vegas Strip. Caesar's Palace and Aria have roughly 1,500 slots apiece. The details, including location or design, are unknown. A required feasibility study in August evaluated 5 sites outside downtown, including a former U.S. steel plant site, but recommended one closer to the city's core. Mayor Lori Lightfoot says downtown is still in play. Sites often discussed include the state-owned James R. Thompson Center and an aging McCormick Place building. Legislators also approved 5 other casinos, sports betting, and more slots at horse tracks and Illinois' existing 10 casinos. First-year Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the package into law during the summer as a critical funding source for a $45 billion capital plan. Chicago would use profits to pay down pension debt. Revenue estimates vary. State experts agree the Chicago casino will easily outperform Illinois' highest-grossing casino, Rivers Casino, in the suburb of Des Plaines, which generated $440 million last year with its $1,200 gambling positions. The feasibility study said one site at a former hospital could gross over $950 million by year 5, but there's a big hitch. The same feasibility study said the onerous tax and fee structure in the gambling law, the highest nationwide, would make a Chicago casino not financially feasible. The effective tax rate would be up to 72%, including a 33% tax on gross casino receipts that Chicago would use for police and fire pensions. The one-third rate, which applies to Chicago and not the other casinos, was written into the plan after lawmakers rejected the idea of a city-owned casino. The study concluded any casino operator's revenue would likely equate to a few pennies on the dollar. Legislators and city officials were negotiating fixes, but lawmakers adjourned their fall veto session without taking addressing the issue. State Representative Bob Rita, a Blue Island Democrat who sponsored the expansion, introduced a city-backed plan to lower some taxes and fees, but said lawmakers ran out of time for a vote. Lightfoot said they'll pursue the issue in January. With so much potential on the line, our city and state deserve to get this done and get this done right. Experts say casinos can have 2 major benefits for cities: economic growth and tax revenue. Chicago leaders have long found both ideas alluring. Former Mayor Richard M. Daley floated a plan in the early 1990s for a $2 billion city-owned casino complex that would feature family-friendly entertainment. Former Mayor Rahm Emanuel pushed proposals to address the city's financial woes. Lightfoot has favored a casino as a way to boost economically depressed neighborhoods and to bring long-term financial stability. The City Council recently approved her proposed $11.65 billion budget, which relies on several one-time funding sources, including a $250 million from debt refinancing. Not everyone is on board, particularly with the social cost. Illinois Church Action on Alcohol and Addiction Problems, a nonprofit group, said that casinos prey on the poor and enable, if not tacitly encourage, gambling addiction. Some Chicago neighborhoods also don't want to profit off of casino dollars. A Chicago alderwoman whose ward covers one proposed site in a historically black neighborhood slammed the idea as akin to putting a casino in Harlem. The Illinois Gaming Association worries about oversaturation with the expansion. The new casinos will be in Chicago's south suburbs, Waukegan, Danville, Rockford, and southern Illinois. Former Governor Pat Quinn vetoed 2 gambling expansions over concerns about ethics and school funding. There are also doubts about the feasibility study conducted by a Las Vegas consultant. Michael Wenz, a Northeastern Illinois University economics professor, said he's not convinced that a Chicago casino wouldn't be profitable even with the current tax structure, and bidding developers should be able to write proposals without impediment. Illinois isn't the only state trying to win big. Illinois Governor Eric Holcomb signed a plan this year that will, among other things, allow two Gary casino boats on Lake Michigan to move to land sites and help open another casino in Terre Haute. He said Gary, 30 miles from Chicago, would absolutely compete with Illinois casinos. It will be on a perfect thoroughfare, and I predict will exceed expectations as they are right now, Holcomb said over the summer. Rockford officials have also kept a close eye on the Wisconsin border with plans underway for a $405 million casino in Beloit. Even without the legislative delays, a ribbon cutting will take a while. The Illinois Gaming Board has a year to review applications and conduct background checks before issuing licenses. In Chicago, there will have to be local location approval and public hearings, then construction can begin. Gaming is a very complicated issue, and it always has been, Rita said. Everybody wants to get it up and running right away and make sure that they do it right. And I'm going to turn to the obituaries that are in Sunday's paper, as we don't want to miss anyone. This first one, Henry Makowiak. Henry Makowiak, 96, of Westville, was called home to his Heavenly Father peacefully on November 26th at home. A mass of Christian burial will be at noon Monday, December 2nd, at St. Mary's Catholic Church on North State Street in Westville, with Father Salpe officiating. Visitation will be 11 a.m. to noon Monday at the church prior to Mass. That's already happened. He will be laid to rest in Saints Peter and Paul Cemetery in Westville. Lila Mae Posiliak. Lila Mae Posiliak, P-O-C-I-A-L-I-K. 99 of Centralia, passed away Monday, November 25th at St. Mary's Hospital in Centralia. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Tuesday, December 3rd at St. Anthony's Church in Hoopston, with Father Thomas Gibson officiating. Burial will follow at Floral Hill Cemetery in Hoopston. Visitation will be 9 to 10 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Annabelle G. Wright. Annabelle G. Wright, 89, of Danville, passed away November 29th peacefully at her home. A celebration of Annabelle's life will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, December 2nd, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville, 3940 North Vermilion Street, with Chaplain Patsy Arnold officiating. Visitation will be from 8 to 11 a.m. Monday, prior to the service. Memorials can be made in her name to the American Cancer Society. Thomas Lawrence Dreyer. Thomas Dreyer's journey continued Saturday evening, November 23rd, reuniting with his loving wife of 56 years, Nancy. It does not give us any kind of a memorial or any kind of services in this particular announcement. Charles Sturries. Charles Robert Sturries, 75, of Champaign and Danville, passed away November 20th at OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville. A visitation in his honor will be 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. today at Morgan Memorial Home in Savoy. A funeral service will follow at 11:30 a.m. Monday at Morgan Memorial Home, officiated by the Reverend Richard McGuire. Immediately following the service, burial rites will take place in Mount Hope Cemetery in Champaign next to his parents. Christine Lynn DeSutter. Christine Lynn Kraut DeSutter, 59, of Vetersburg, Indiana, passed away at her residence at 5:45 p.m. Friday, November 29th, with her family by her side. Visitation is today, 4 to 8, Sterling Christian Church on Sterling Avenue in Vetersburg, Indiana. The funeral service will be tomorrow at 11 a.m., the 3rd, at Sterling Christian Church, with Pastor Gary Johnson officiating. Burial will follow the service at Rockfield Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be given to the Vetersburg Food Pantry or the American Cancer Society. Unfortunately, most of those have already taken place, but those are the ones that are in the paper today or yesterday. This headline, more candidates file for county office. Filings are underway for county positions in the spring 2020 election. As of Wednesday afternoon, those who had filed included for auditor Mary Techtow and Erica Briggs, both Republicans. They both filed at 8 a.m. Monday, so a lottery will be needed to determine name placement on the ballot. Circuit Clerk Melissa Quick, Republican. Coroner Incumbent Jane C. McFadden, a Republican. Recorder of Deeds Incumbent Dave Stone, Republican. State's Attorney Incumbent Jacqueline M. Lacey, Republican. Sandy Lawless, Democrat. County Board District 1, incumbent Joel L. Byrd, Republican, and Connor Gilansky, Democrat. County Board District 2, incumbents Charles D. Maccabee III and Kevin Gale Green. Both are Republicans, and they filed at the same time, 8 a.m. Monday. A lottery will take place for name placement on the ballot. County Board District 3, Shelley McLean, Republican. County Board District 4, incumbents Robert Mitchweaver and Marla Makowicz, both Republican. A lottery will be needed. Also, Carl E. Johnson, a Democrat. County Board District 5, Chrissy Walls, a Republican. County Board District 6, Mary Ellen Serpernot, Republican, and Tom Moore, Republican. County Board District 7, Jerry Hawker, Republican. County Board District 8, incumbent Nancy O'Kane, Democrat, Robert Boyd, a Democrat. County Board District 9, incumbent Becky Stark, a Democrat. Petition packets must be filed by 5 p.m. December 2nd. Petition packets for candidates who wish to run in the general primary election on March 17, 2020, can be picked up between 8 and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at the Vermilion County Clerk's Office. The office is in the Vermilion County Administration Building, 201 North Vermilion Street. Federal, state, and judicial offices will also be on the ballot. The candidate who receives the highest vote total in each political party for each office in the primary will be on the November 3, 2020 general election ballot. And a few community briefs. UAW Party. The United Auto Workers Local 579 General Motors Retirees Christmas Party will be at noon on Wednesday in the Union Hall on Tilton Road. The local will furnish meat, rolls, drinks, and table service. Bring a covered dish to share. Only UAW 579 retirees, spouses, and surviving spouses are eligible to attend. There is no charge. Concert planned. Maury Chapel, Church of Christ, 19194 East 1100 North Road, plans a holiday gospel sing at 5:30 p.m. December 7th. Forgiven from Covington, Indiana will be the featured singers, and a meal will follow the concert. Bazaar set. Faith Church, 107 East Vance Street, plans its Christmas Bazaar and Farmers Market for 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. December 7th. Gifts, crafts, baked goods, books, and jewelry will be available. Breakfast and lunch from Hooligans to Go. And some more casino news. Officials hear details on Indiana Casino by Howard Greninger. Prospective Terre Haute casino operator Spectacle Entertainment on Tuesday briefed Vigo County officials on a proposed $125 million casino to be located on 22 acres south of Walmart East next to Holiday Inn Express. John Keeler, a Spectacle vice president, said the casino would be called the Roxino by Hard Rock, would be 100,000 square feet, and employ about 600 workers if the company is awarded the state casino license. The Roxino would include sports betting, a 300-seat entertainment theater called the Velvet Lounge, a buffet, a cafe, bars, a steakhouse, and other features, Keeler said. A new limited liability corporation called Spectacle Jack, LLC, would be the owner of the casino, he said at the Vigo County Board of Commissioners meeting. The Indiana Gaming Commission is accepting proposals from prospective casino operators through Monday. Applying for the license requires a $50,000 fee, and the successful applicant would pay the commission a $5 million license fee. The state has set a $100 million minimum investment on the part of the operator. The Gaming Commission will review applications and is expected to award the license in the first quarter of 2020. Spectacle Entertainment and Full House Resorts both have publicly stated interest in operating a Vigo casino. Terre Haute businessman Craig Gibson is one of the lead investors in and vice president of Spectacle. Also at the commissioners' meeting, Terre Haute City Council President Martha Croson and Christine Craig, president of the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce, said a group was formed to consider a local development agreement with Spectacle. That group included Croson, Craig, County Board of Commissioners President Brad Anderson, Terre Haute Mayor Duke Bennett, and County Council President Aaron Loudermilk. They met several times, including twice with Spectacle officials, including Gibson and Keeler. A local development agreement is one of the requirements set forth by the state law that allows a Terre Haute casino. Under the development agreement, as now structured, a five-member foundation board would distribute an estimated $3 million annually in casino funds. Croson said the foundation board would have two casino owner representatives, but those members do have to be local residents. The other members would be a city council member appointed by the mayor of Terre Haute, one appointed by the president of the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce, and the other a member of the Vigo County Council appointed by the president of the Board of Commissioners. County commissioners are to meet again Monday to discuss the issue. A vote is expected. Croson said she expects the distributing foundation to conduct its work in public, and she will ask that it provide an annual report to the city council. The money from the development agreement is the third leg of the local proceeds distribution. The largest payment to local government is from a wagering tax estimated to be about $4.6 million. This will go to the city of Terre Haute if a casino is inside the city limits. With an admissions tax, a tax levied against the casino for each person who enters, the Vigo County Casino is estimated to generate more than $2.6 million. That money would be divided among the city of Terre Haute, which would receive 40% or more than $1 million, Vigo County government at 30% or more than $780,000, Vigo County School Corporation at 15% or more than $390,000, West Central 2025, a regional economic development effort through the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce at 15% or more than $390,000. Keeler's at Spectacles projections estimate local government proceeds and the nonprofit distribution should total about $9 million to $10 million annually. And this editorial from the Commercial News. Land Bank will be a valuable tool. What started as the Vermilion County Land Bank, a public organization designed to help revitalization efforts, has grown to become the Central Illinois Land Bank. With that growth comes the potential to create real change in area cities. The Central Illinois Land Bank recently named Michael Davis as its director and now represents more than a dozen communities in Vermilion, Champaign, and Macon counties. Land banks can use funding from a variety of sources to help fight blight and spark revitalization. For example, in Vermilion County, the land bank has purchased property available at the county's delinquent tax auction with the goal of getting that parcel back on the tax rolls. With such a wide representation within the land bank, there are sure to be conflicts about how and where the limited dollars available will be spent. But the value of using the potential funding power of such a large group offsets those concerns. Instead of clearing a lot or two at a time, an organization the size of the Central Illinois Land Bank will be able to take on significant projects that will make it a noticeable difference within its cities. Danville and Vermilion County stands to benefit greatly from such efforts. Dilapidated housing ranks among the biggest problems in many communities. These buildings not only create health and safety hazards, but they decrease the value of surrounding property, thereby hurting everyone in the community by creating a decrease in tax revenue. That's only part of a land bank's value. They also prevent such substandard housing from being put up for rent by those interested only in squeezing a few dollars out of those who don't have a lot to spend. Creating competition for those types of buildings will improve the community no matter who ends up owning them. Land banks play only a part of the effort needed for communities' revitalization efforts. For real success, those efforts also need to have the support of other local government units and the public. Creating the Central Illinois Land Bank gives local officials one more tool to help improve their communities. Holiday help, Bennett seeks socks. To help boost supplies at local shelters during the cold winter months, Illinois State Senator Scott Bennett, Democrat of Champaign, is launching a warm socks drive. Until December 16th, community members can donate unused socks for men, women, and children at Bennett's Danville office in Suite 323 of the Vermilion County Administration Building at 201 North Vermilion Street, the Georgetown Public Library, and at Stock and Field North on Vermilion Street in Danville. Donations will benefit Cross Point at the Y Homeless Program, Danville Rescue Mission, and Fair Hope Children's Ministry. Socks are a greatly needed item at shelters, but are the least donated clothing item to those in need. Most individuals wear out their own socks before throwing them away, meaning that homeless individuals are a serious risk of foot disease and, during the winter months, in severe danger from the cold when there are battered socks on their feet. Scholarships deadline approaches. The Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration Committee is accepting applications for the MLK Scholarship. To be eligible for the $4,000 scholarship, applicants must be a 2020 high school graduating senior who plans to pursue his or her education in an institution of higher learning. Applications are available at local churches, high schools, and the City of Danville Human Relations Department. The selection of the scholarship recipient by the MLK committee is not based on any racial, religious, ethnic, or cultural affiliation. Therefore, students who meet the criteria listed in the scholarship application are encouraged to apply. All scholarship applications must be submitted to the City of Danville Human Relations Department by 4:30 p.m. this Friday, December 6th. The recipient will be announced at the MLK Celebration Banquet in January. For information, contact Chair Mary Thompson at 442-7917 or Sandra Finch at 431-2280. And now some news from the high school scene and sports. Vikings learn a valuable lesson in the loss by Chad Dare. Some lessons are easy to teach while the others have to be taught the hard way. The Danville Vikings had to learn the hard way on Saturday night in the championship game of the Lincoln Eaton Thanksgiving tournament. Lincoln used its tenacious 1-2-2 zone to stymie Danville to a 22.6% shooting from the field, and the Vikings were an abysmal 2 of 24 from the three-point range as the host Rail Splitters claimed the title with a 43-31 triumph. "It's a great experience to play Lincoln in Lincoln," Danville first-year coach Jarrell Robinson said. "That is a 27-win team with four returning starters. I knew we were getting ourselves what we were getting ourselves into tonight." But knowing it and experiencing it are two different things. The Vikings looked like they were sinking in quicksand during the first half, missing shots on the offensive, and while the Rail Splitters were knocking down 7 of 18 from a three-point range on the way to a 23-9 lead at halftime. "I take the blame for this," said Danville junior forward Tevin Smith. "I didn't do what I was supposed to do as a leader. It wasn't just missed shots. We also made mistakes on defense." Actually, Lincoln, 4-0, didn't shoot the ball great on Saturday night. The Rail Splitters shot just 33 1/3%, 15 of 45, but that was considerably better than the Vikings. "I felt that we competed, especially on the defensive end," said Robinson. "We would make a couple of defensive stops, get a couple of good looks, but we didn't capitalize. Against a team like Lincoln, you have to capitalize on every opportunity that you get." Lincoln took control of the contest in the first 3 minutes with three-pointers from Caden Froby, Will Ewald, and Cameron Whiteman that gave the Rail Splitters a 9-3 lead, and they never looked back. After a Nathaniel Hoskins three-pointer with 5:59 left in the first quarter, Danville missed its next 12 shots as Lincoln went on a 14-0 run. "Some of the shots were open and some were a little contested. We can take that," Smith said. "The shots just didn't fall, and we did not play well." Robinson pointed out that the Lincoln defense focused on Danville's leading scorers, Smith and Hoskins, while it let other guys have open looks. "There was a reason that guys got open all of the time," he said. "We need to get to a point where we identify ourselves and know who should be taking those shots." He also wanted to see his team move the ball better against the zone. "Ball reversal is big against these guys," Robinson said. "Give Lincoln and Coach Neil Alexander all of the credit. They did a great job of keeping the ball on one side of the floor." All week, Robinson talked about how the Lincoln tournament was a good learning experience for his team. He felt the same way about Saturday's loss. "We learned against a high-quality opponent in their gym," he said. Smith added, "This is the first week of the season, and we're going to get better over the next 3 months." He added, "It's also a reminder that there are teams just as good as Danville out there. We feel we are one of the top teams. We just need to get better and get ourselves there," he said. Danville will play its first home game on Tuesday night when the Vikings host the Chicago or Spartans. It will be the home debut for Robinson, a Danville graduate. Hoskins and Smith were the only Vikings in double figures on Saturday. Hoskins had 13 points and Smith had 11 to go along with 11 rebounds. Both players were selected for the all-tournament team. And that's all we have time for today. It is Monday, December the 2nd. You have a good day today, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.